Can everybody hear me okay?
Yes.
Yep.
Not too loud or not too quiet?
Just fine.
Okay, so I'm going to be talking about recent work in collaboration with Christian Bohmer. It's been published in PRD, and you can find the archive number on the title page there. And we're trying to look at loop quantum effects and how they affect the interior of the Schwarzschild black hole. So if you can move to the next slide, or the first slide. So this is kind of coming after some recent advances in loop quantum cosmology. Is someone dialing in right now?
Yeah. You can continue.
Okay. In the last year, year and a half, I guess, and the major results are that we see a replacement of the Big Bang singularity, with a big bounce when we're looking at Friedman, Robertson, Walker isotropic cosmologies. And that's work starting with Ashtekar, Pavlovsky, and Singh last year, and I've been involved in some of that. But the major advance that went on was the ability to complete the full quantum program of loop quantum cosmology. And in particular, we've been able to construct a physical Hilbert space, physical inner product, compute Dirac observables, and evolve physical semi-classical states and compute the Dirac observables in the case where we have a simple model of the FRW spacetime with matter in the form of a massless scalar field. And going through those advances, we found that this Big Bang is replaced with a big bounce. There's also been another advance in that the original loop quantum cosmology Hamiltonian constraint, we've kind of found that it has a bad semi-classical limit. And there's been a new improved Hamiltonian constraint operator constructed. And we kind of colloquially call it the mu bar quantization versus the original mu naught. So the mu naught quantization would have the bad semi-classical limit, whereas the mu bar quantization would not. And what we found is more physical results, that they make sense on a more physical level, and that they have a good semi-classical limit. And this was shown last year in the same work. So in order to extend, what we'd like to do is obviously extend these rigorous results to more complicated scenarios. You know, one possibility is relaxing the assumption of isotropy, or going on to even more challenging models. But it turns out to be quite challenging, obviously, because the models become more complex. So one thing that would be nice is, could we have kind of an approximate shortcut to the physical predictions in an approximate sense? And what it was shown in the isotropic case was that there was a kind of understanding, and that there was a phenomenological effective theory, where if you incorporate the holonomy features of the Hamiltonian constraint, you can, into a kind of a semi-classical model of this theory, then you can provide an explanation for the bounce. And what happens is that in that model, the Friedman equation gets modified with a term that's quadratic in the energy density, goes with an overall minus sign. And then if you can see from the Friedman equation there that when the energy density hits a critical value, the rho c, then gravity acts repulsively, and that's where the bounce occurs. And so what one would then might ask, well, does that actually approximate the quantum results, and does it approximate it well? And that was shown to be the case. But in this sort of this simple model with a massless scalar field. And one of the things that comes out is, if you look at the mu bar quantization, what we find is that this rho c, this critical energy density, is Planckian. And that might be what you'd expect from a quantum theory of cosmology. Whereas if you look at the original mu naught quantization, you could find that this critical density can be arbitrarily small. And that doesn't seem to make much sense. So if we can go to the next slide. So what I want to talk about today is, what can we say, can we extend some of these results to black hole singularities? What will happen in that case? And the simplest thing to look at is the interior of a Schwarzschild black hole, because it can be treated as a homogeneous but anisotropic, a Kantosky-Sachs type model. And this sort of loop quantization, the initial loop quantization of this interior, has been done by Ashtekar and Boyevol in 2006. but their quantization was analogous to the mu naught quantization of loop quantum cosmology. Although, they're very similar. Quantizing this simple model is quite similar to loop quantum cosmology, since it's a homogeneous model. And also, in that paper, they've only constructed the constraint operator, and there's no construction of the physical sector. So Modesto has also looked at this kind of phenomenological effective theory of this model, but again, nobody has been able to construct a true quantum physical sector, and that is, of course, difficult mathematically. And if we try to do a mu-naught quantization of this model, then understanding the quantum physical sector is even more difficult. So what I'm going to talk about today is to analyze this the phenomenological effective equations for the improved mu bar quantization, the analog of the mu bar quantization. And of course, the things we're going to be interested in is what happens with the singularity. And one thing we can analyze is if you have an infalling test particle, what does it do? Does it fall into a singularity, or does something else come out of that? Okay, so if we can change to the next slide. So I'm just going to describe right now the classical framework for the Schwarzschild interior. And it's homogeneous in the sense that if you flip the usual Schwarzschild temporal and radial coordinates, then the metric components are now only depending on the temporal, the new temporal coordinate. And so your metric is given there. You have the lapse function multiplied as just a function of time multiplying the dt, the temporal part of the metric. And then you have two degrees of freedom for the metric, spatial degrees of freedom. You have the g. Well, x here is the new radial coordinate. So you have a gxx metric component that's a function of t, and then you have the two-sphere metric, the d omega squared there. So you have a g omega omega. That would be the other component of the spatial metric. Now, again, it's just a function of time. So in this sense, we now have two spatial degrees of freedom for the metric. So it's an anisotropic model, but it's homogeneous in the sense that they're only time-dependent components. And then it's given explicitly. You see the form right there. With the line element, you have the lapse square term is just 2m over t minus 1, the inverse of that. And that should be familiar from the Schwarzschild metric. So again, they're homogeneous. It's a homogeneous metric, but it's an anisotropic type. And there's two dynamical spatial components of the metric. The d omega squared is just your ordinary unit two-sphere metric. And so the g omega omega component of the metric is what's going to determine the physical radius of the two-sphere. And we're going to use that to interpret the results from the effect of the quantum result. The topologies are across SO3, so the radial coordinate x is can take on all values, all real values. And the Schwarzschild interior is recovered when you look at the range of the temporal coordinates going from 0 to 2 times the mass. Okay, so we can go on to the next slide. So the goal is, of course, to quantize this theory, and using techniques that are familiar from loop quantum cosmology and obviously from loop quantum gravity. So we need to describe this classical framework in terms of connection and triad variables. And the idea is the same idea in loop quantum cosmology. You'd want to assume the Kontosky-Sachs symmetry for your connection and triad. So you're reducing these triads, the connection and triad variables at the classical level, and then you insert the reduced variables into the Hamiltonian and quantize the symmetry reduced degrees of freedom. So it's completely analogous to loop quantum cosmology. So when we look at the triad, it's going to be determined now by two dynamical quantities, which we label as P, B, and PC. And they are related, since the triad is related to the the three metric, the spatial metric. They are going to be related to the two metric degrees of freedom, the gxx, the radial part, and the two-sphere part, g omega omega. and it's given in the following equation. GXX is just PB squared over PC, and then G omega, omega is the absolute value of PC. So just using that, you plug that right into the, and you, into the metric, and you get the line element right below that. The connection is also going to be determined by two dynamical quantities, and just label that B and C. And the B is going to be conjugate to the triad component PB, obviously, and C is going to be conjugate to PC. And the Poisson brackets are given right there. You have B and PB are conjugate, with the Poisson bracket given by G times the Mirzi parameter. And then C and PC are conjugate, and all other Poisson brackets are going to vanish. Finally, if we plug in these variables into the Hamiltonian, we get the Hamiltonian given right there. So it looks somewhat similar to a loop quantum cosmology framework. You have kind of, it's quadratic in connection components. You have B squared term there. You have a B times C term. And then it goes as a square root of a triad component, like square root of PC on the first term, or PB over square root of PC, which is quite similar to loop quantum cosmology. Okay, if we can move on to the next slide. So once we have the Hamiltonian and we have the basic Poisson structure, we have the basic variables, we can just go forth and derive the equations of motion. And they're given by the standard Hamilton's equations. So the time derivative of PB, for instance, the triad component PB, is just given by the Poisson bracket of that variable with a Hamiltonian. And that's just given through the Poisson brackets, just proportional to the derivative of the Hamiltonian with respect to the connection component B, and so forth. You can do that for all of the base-based variables. And, of course, the Hamiltonian is constrained to be, Hamiltonian is a constraint, so it should vanish also, giving us an equation of motion. So once we have these equations of motion, we'd like to be able to identify, at least at the classical level, where is the horizon and where is the singularity in terms of these triad variables, because all the effective dynamics is going to be based on the triad variables and not the metric variables. So for the horizon, if we go back one slide, the horizon is given when the G omega omega term is equal to 2m, and when the GXX term is equal to 0. And so that means that this value of the PC component is going to be given by 2m, and the value of the PB component is 0 at the horizon. Okay. And that's given on that slide number 5. So PB equals 0 at the horizon, and PC is non-zero in proportional to the mass squared. And similarly for the singularity, if we go back to slide 4, the singularity is given when G omega omega is 0, and also when GXX is 0. No, wait a second. Is GXX 0 at the singularity? The GXX blows up at t equal to 0. The important thing is that PB also vanishes at the singularity. Actually, we can show it down in the line or two below that. But the two-sphere component, PC, is equal to 0 at the singularity, and also PB is equal to 0. So that's how we're going to identify where the singularity is and the horizon are in the quantum effective dynamics. Okay, so in terms of going through and actually deriving the equations of motion, they can be solved explicitly, and obviously you're going to get back the Schwarzschild solution when you assume you can start your evolution, for instance, at the horizon with boundary values, and then solve the equations of motion, and you get the Schwarzschild solution. So explicitly we have the PC component is T squared, and the PB component goes as T times the square root of 2m over T minus 1. And from there you can see if I plug in T equal to 0, which is the singularity, then I find that PB is 0 and also PC is 0. So that gives back our identification of the singularity, and so forth. You can get B as a the connection components, but those aren't too important. The important parts are the triad behavior. So, in terms of interpreting the quantum effects, what I'm going to show today is, well, first of all, as I've said, the PC component is related to the G omega omega, the omega omega metric component. And so that's directly related to the physical radius of the two-sphere. So we're going to use that knowledge. And also, if we take a test particle and we get an effective metric, we can calculate radial geodesics, for instance, and ask what happens for an infalling particle. And that's just going to satisfy the geodesic equation. In terms of these triad variables, the geodesic equation is just dt, t here is coordinate time, with respect to d tau, tau would be the proper time. That quantity squared is just given by the factor on the right, so pc times epsilon squared, epsilon would be the energy in infinity, divided by pb squared, plus 2, then all of it divided by the lap squared. So we can, once we have solved for pc as a function of time and pb as a function of time, then we can integrate this equation and get the behavior of the radial geodesic. Okay? Are there any questions so far?
Go ahead.
Okay. So let's move on to slide number 6. So now I want to get into how we deal with trying to analyze the quantum dynamics. And so it is a homogeneous model, as I've just shown. And it can be, it's very similar to a loop quantum cosmology model, so it can be quantized in completely analogous fashion. And as I mentioned, this was done 2006. What the end result is that you get a quantum difference equation that would have finite steps, step sizes in terms of the triad variables PB and PC. And ideally what we'd like to do is construct semi-classical states, determine a physical inner product, calculate expectation values of Dirac observables. But as I mentioned earlier, this becomes quite complicated if you want to do an improved mu bar like quantization. In particular, if you have a mu bar quantization, the discrete structure of the difference equation is going to be much more complicated. So what we've done is to simplify things and just look at incorporating the Hanvi effect. As I said, this phenomenological theory that just incorporates these effects and looks at a modified classical Hamiltonian. Classical in the sense that not in that it gives classical GR, but it gives a modified classical theory. But again, the equations of motion that you're dealing with would be classical and not quantum. And so we derive equations of motion and analyze those. So the key point is that we're going to be, I'm going to be showing you a modified classical Hamiltonian. And then once that has been determined, you can go through the equations of motion and derive what you want to derive. So in particular, to understand where these effects are coming from is the fact that if you look at a holonomy in terms of these symmetry reduced variables, they're going to look in a, look like, in a rough sense, exponentials of the connection components. So for instance, if you had a classical, in the Hamiltonian, if you had a classical term that looked like the connection component B, in the quantum theory, you're going to get an exponential of the connection components. It's going to be something like e to the I times B, multiplied by some parameter delta B. And where these delta B, you would have a delta C term also. These are just proportional to the holonomy edge length that you use to construct the Hamiltonian constraint operator. So they're going to play an important role in measuring the effects of the quantum effects in that might arise in the difference equation. In particular, larger values of delta mean stronger quantum effects. You can kind of see that if I have e to the I b times delta b, then if delta b is small, that's going to go to, well, it's going to go to 1 plus I times b delta b. But you can recover connection component b in the limit that the delta parameters go to 0. And these delta parameters are related to these, what we keep saying, mu naught and the mu bar parameters of loop quantum cosmology. So in the work of Ashtekar and Boyevold, these delta parameters were taken to be constants, and they're completely analogous to the mu naught parameter that went into the original works of loop quantum cosmology. So in the first work, in the Schwarzschild interior, those were taken to be constants, and that's completely analogous. So, as I mentioned, the more recent work in loop quantum cosmology, these parameters, these delta Bs and delta Cs, have been taken not to be constant anymore, but actually depend explicitly on the triad components. And there's some strong motivation for why this should be. And the end result is that we get better semi-classical limit and more physical results.
Kevin?
Yeah.
Just to clarify this thing. So you sort of emphasize that you're going to modify classical Hamiltonian, etc. But these parameters delta have H bar in them. I just want to make sure that I'm understanding this correctly. And therefore, what you call a classical Hamiltonian, although it's a function of the phase space, its expression would actually contain factors of H bar. Is this correct?
That's correct. So I think it would make sense. It's like a classical Hamiltonian plus corrections that are coming from the quantum side, and those corrections would be dependent on H bar or the Planck length or what you want.
Kevin, can I ask a question?
Yeah.
This is Carlos from Marseille, and this question is late. I should have asked before when you were looking for questions, but I'm just late in thinking. You have four variables, so 2 degrees of freedom, 1 constraint, so one physical degree of freedom in the model, just the gravitational part, right? And so the space of solutions is supposed to be two-dimensional. One I suppose is m, the mass. What is the other parameter that differentiates solutions? Is there another one?
I think that would be it, right? I think it'd just be the mass. I mean, in looking at the solution, it's just the mass that's parameterizing the solution.
So why is the second one disappearing? What is? I mean, if you have a 2 degrees of freedom with 1 constraint, you expect 1 degree of freedom. So a two-parameter family of classical solutions, right? Like position and velocity as initial data.
Mm-hmm.
Is that something peculiar happening, or?
I'm not entirely sure, actually. There are other, I mean, the solution I gave in slide number 5, there is another parameter that goes into it, but we tend to think of it as just a gauge parameter.
Which is what? What is the other parameter?
I haven't showed it, but it would just be an overall multiplicative factor for PB, and it would also show up, I think, in the equation for C as a function of time.
I think there is a, Pablo, you are right. I think there is a tension between a space-space framework and space-time framework, just as is also for the N-Q1 models. Right? And as Kevin just explained, in the space-space framework, if you look at the solutions, there is an extra parameter.
Yeah.
But in the space-time framework, just using the space-time diffeomorphism freedom, one can show that those that extra parameter doesn't matter. That is to say, they're all related to each other, but for space-time diffeomorphism. This is a subtle issue. It has to do with kind of sometimes an extension between the Hamiltonian framework and what we think of as space-time metric.
Okay.
Maybe we can come back to that at the end.
Okay. So, thank you.
I think if you think of it in terms of the Schwarzschild geometry, one parameter is the mass, and the other one is like the time at infinity that you use, which is a conjugate of the mass, so to speak, which in the space-time picture plays no role.
Right, exactly. And this is kind of something that Oren is pointing out, or something that was elaborated in detail by Carol Kukas, right, Oren?
Yeah, and then you also have a paper with Joseph Samuel many years ago, right?
Okay, thank you.
Okay, and I left it out for simplicity, and like Abe said, that whatever value it takes, it doesn't affect the actual physical results. Okay, is there anything else? Okay, so then we can move on to slide 7. Okay, so in terms of what the actual effective Hamiltonian that we're working with looks like, it's just given right here. And like I said, when you have classical factors of the connection components, for instance, in the Hamiltonian, we have the first term goes like B times C. Then in the way we didn't deal with those in terms of incorporating the holonomy effects is to replace those B and C terms with sine of B times delta B divided by delta B terms. And the same thing for C. And you can see that that's the effective Hamiltonian in the second line that we're dealing with. Every factor of B is being replaced by a sine term. And if you look at it, like I said, the delta B parameters are measuring the effects, the quantum effects. So smaller values of delta B is going to behave more classically. And you can see that if you were to take the limit of this effective Hamiltonian, just take delta B and delta C going to zero, then you would get back the classical Hamiltonian. And I must mention, you know, the caveats of the model we're working in. We're not actually dealing in detail with the quantum theory. So this is a sort of, as I mentioned, a phenomenological theory that we're just looking at. We're considering what are the possible effects if we look at these types of corrections. But it's not a, there's no, we don't have a rigorous derivation of this effective Hamiltonian coming from the quantum theory itself. So there might be additional corrections that come in from the quantum theory. In terms of the isotropic loop quantum cosmology results with a massless scalar field, working with this type of effective Hamiltonian has provided an excellent accounting of the results. And so we have some hope that that these results are robust. And like I said, we're interested in the effects of these corrections. It's not necessarily the final word. So that should be kept in mind when we discuss all these results. Meaning that there is, of course, more work that would need to be done. So if I were to just look at this effective Hamiltonian, but look at the case where these delta parameters are taken to be constants, i.e. the mu naught sort of quantization, then this is exactly what Leonardo Modesto has looked at in a paper from last year. And I'm not going to spend too much time on the results, but what he found is that the singularity is avoided in the effective equations, and in that there is a balance in the two-sphere radius component. So in specifically, the triad component PC, which was proportional to the G omega omega component, that is bounded to be above the value of a value that's proportional to the Mirzi parameter, to the value of the delta parameters, and also the mass of the black hole. And that's shown on the plot at the right, which shows a radial geodesic, the value of the PC component as a function of proper time. And so an infalling observer in this is sort of model would initially fall towards the singularity, which is his trajectory is given by the red line. This is the quantum effect. Quantum trajectory, the black line would be the classical solution. So an infalling observer would just fall into the singularity in finite proper time. But actually, this observer bounces and then moves out to another classical regime, but it looks like a different sized black hole after the bounce. And you can tell that because the value of the PC component was proportional to the mass at the horizon. And so you can see in this plot, it starts out at some value, probably on the order of 5, and then ends up at some value on the order of 1,000. So in this case, it would bounce to some larger sized black hole. Although the interpretation is not entirely clear. But so what I want to talk about is, of course, the newer results if we do the mu-bar type quantization. So
before you move on, let me make a point here. Of course, you could choose the deltas in such a way that the two masses are equal. And you could also choose the deltas in such a way that, like in other cosmologies, you depart from the sort of classical GR behavior long away from the bounds. Yeah, so that's just like usual. So.
Yeah, so I agree. This I put in that you can make the solution symmetric, so it looks like the same black hole on both sides of the belt, just like Jorge just said. Okay.
I have a couple of questions.
Yeah.
Hi. So my first question is, like, in your effective Hamiltonian, you are not touching the square root of triad and the inverse triad.
That's right.
So that's an additional assumption that you are just, like, in this nice sense polymerizing the connection.
Yeah. So I have, in our work, we have not looked at the sort of inverse triad effects that you see in loop quantum cosmology.
But not only the inverse triad, but the square root of PC?
Yeah, but that's also coming from an inverse triad effect.
From a p-metric.
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
But I think, like, it will be good to look at, like, to add to the intuition which we had from LQC, like, that inverse triad corrections don't matter.
Yeah.
It's an assumption here at the moment that they don't matter.
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah, so we're just looking at these effects.
Yeah. And my second question is, because you have motivated your work from the improved dynamics of LQC, and there it was, well, there we had no other choice because the earlier contribution had failed to give the semi-classical limit. But I would like to understand what results Modesto obtained. Like, for example, when he did the mu naught phenomenology, did he obtain bounds which is not at some invariant scale? Like, and does your work improve on that phenomenology, or we don't understand the problems well?
Yeah, there are issues like this. I mean, first of all, you mentioned the semi-classical limit. From the plot and from the actual effective solution, in this case, you do have an okay semi-classical limit, which you can see from the plot. Away from the bounce, then you'd be close to a semi-classical. So that, at least that issue is okay. But there are other gauge issues that would affect
So my question is that you are motivating everything like mu bar versus mu naught, but if I do the mu naught phenomenology for the Schwarzschild interior, do I see immediate problems as I saw in loop quantum cosmology? Are there any gauge artifacts which are left?
Yes.
Okay. If they're left.
Yes.
Okay.
Just to amplify this, Abhay, just to, Jorge was just mentioning that, in fact, if you, in this mu naught kind of formulation, you could choose the values of delta Bs and so on, such that there would be violation of even at the classical level, right? That there'd be contradictions to general relativity, even in domains where they should not be.
Yeah, just like in another cosmological model, there's nothing new.
Right. So this looks like not what Kevin just replied to, because Kevin was saying that in this case there is no problem with the classical limit. So I just want to understand this.
I think Kevin wants to say that if one looks at the semi-classical limit, whether it goes to classical GR, I think, like, we have, like, maybe we can postpone this discussion. But even in the loop quantum cosmology, unless you take a cosmological constant, you don't see problems at the semi-classical limit. If you are just playing with a massless scalar, you will not see the problem, even in mu naught. But the problems are still there in a subtle way because they are gauge dependence issues of b naught and so on.
Yes, yes. But it would be the same thing here.
So I think Kevin is just saying that even if you choose your delta b, delta c cleverly enough so that you may see a semi-classical limit, there may be still gauge issues which are left.
Okay.
That would be my point, yes. Although I didn't want to go into too much detail, obviously, in this talk, since we don't have an infinite amount of time. Is there anything else? Okay, so let's move to slide 8. So as I mentioned, we want to do the non-constant delta case now, where these delta parameters are going to depend on the triad components PB and PC explicitly. In terms of loop quantum cosmology, the prescription is this mu bar parameter, which is analogous to these delta parameters, is going to be proportional to some constant capital delta divided by the triad component, square root of the triad component, or in terms of the scale factor, that would vary as 1 over the scale factor. And then the method used to constrain the the explicit behavior is to take this loop that's formed by in constructing the Hamiltonian constraint and constraining it to have a minimum, the minimum area of loop quantum gravity. And that just leads to identification of this capital delta constant just being equal to the minimum area of loop quantum gravity. Now, in our case here with the Schwarzschild interior, it is an anisotropic model, so one has maybe a little bit more freedom in ways of trying to implement this procedure. And there have kind of been two possible approaches that have been discussed in the literature, mainly in terms of the Bianchi 1 model. In the scheme A that I've listed here, it's more a geometric approach, and that's just to take the classical area of the holonomy loops and then calculate the area and set it equal to the minimum. And the end result is just the delta parameters are given right there. The delta B is proportional to 1 over the square root of PC. Then the delta C goes to the square root of PC over PB. And again, this capital delta here can just be taken to be the minimum area in this method of constraining it. Another approach is where this area is taken to be dependent on kind of the transversal holonomy in the constraint operator. That just leads to slightly different behavior where the delta B, for instance, goes as 1 over the square root of PB now, and the delta C goes as 1 over the square root of PC. Slightly simpler model that comes out of this approach. But it's probably less motivated physically, I would say, at least my opinion. the results I'm going to present today are based on the scheme A, since it seems to be more physically motivated. That's also, there's been a stability analysis of, in terms of the Bianchi 1 model, a stability analysis of the quantum difference equation has been done by Boyle, Karten, and Khanna, which seems to indicate that A is the more stable approach. B has been applied in the Bianchi 1 model by Dawei Chu last year, but he's also shown that it suffers from these gauge dependence issues that essentially what Perum was asking about. But I just mentioned that we have looked at both approaches, and the results from B give very similar results to the constant delta case. So you have what looks like kind of two black holes being connected by a bounce in the two-sphere radius. So I'm just going to focus on approach A in all of the talk, for the rest of the talk. I just mentioned that there are other possibilities that one might consider. So why don't we move on to the next slide. So again, just listing the behavior of the delta B and delta C parameters. Again, they go as a 1 over the square root of a triad component, essentially. We have 1 over square root of PC for the delta B, and the delta C is because of the square root of PC divided by PB. And so now I can put this prescription into my effective Hamiltonian and go through the equations of motion just like I would in the classical case. So for instance, I take again, the time derivative of the PB component is just given by the derivative of the Hamiltonian now with respect to the connection component B. And with these non-constant delta parameters, we can't find an analytical solution, so we solve these equations numerically. What we end up getting is equations that are just solving the differential equations, giving us triad components PB and PC as a function of coordinate time T, and also it would give us the connection components B and C. And once those have been solved numerically, then we can analyze the resulting metric, calculate the geodesics, etc. Okay. So let's move on to the next slide. Okay, so the first result I have plotted on the right is the calculation of the two-sphere component PC as a function of coordinate time. And what we find is that it is bounded from below, just like the previous result, but it undergoes a bounce, but it doesn't necessarily bounce up to another classical black hole. What you can see from the plot in red is the quantum solution, and that in the black solution there is the classical solution, and they follow each other until you see that the PC component bounces, and then it it increases, but then it kind of turns around and seems to undergo damped harmonic oscillations. And if we were to continue this evolution on to capital T equal to minus infinity, then it would just settle into a finite radius. So it looks like it's undergoing damped oscillations and then settling into a kind of an equilibrium value. So what we find again in this result is that the singularity is absent here. This PC component is never approaching zero. And so like in the work of Modesto, again we see that the singularity is absent in that it's resolved dynamically. And kind of an interesting result that was completely unexpected is that if you look at the resulting solution for the triad components and with that you calculate the metric components, what it asymptotes to is what is known as a Nerii universe. And that turns out to be a special solution of classical general relativity when you include a cosmological constant. And it's a spherically symmetric solution, but it starts out with the assumption that the two-sphere radius is constant. And in our triad variables, that would imply a constant value of PC. And so that's what's happening here. When PC settles into a constant value, it ends up looking like a Nerii type solution. And I've just shown the metric for the Nerii type would just be given, the line element is given below, where you have the radial component goes as the cos squared of square root of lambda times t. And then the two-sphere component is just a constant equal to 1 over lambda. So we're asymptoting into this type of solution, a special solution of classical general relativity.
Is the value of effective cosmology constant given just by the area gap, or does it also depend on the mass of the initial black hole?
It would just depend on the area gap. So it's just determined by the asymptotic value of PC, and it turns out, which I'll show in the next slide, I think, that it only depends on your area gap. So it's going to depend on the immunity parameter and the area gap, essentially. Those are the
right.
And not the mass. Okay? So let us move to the next slide. So the next thing we looked at is once we have these the triad components and everything, we have essentially an effective metric, and then we can look at the radial infalling geodesic for a test particle. And so I've shown that plot to the right here. It's just a plot of the PC component, the two-sphere radius component, as a function of the proper time of the infalling particle. And again, the black line would be what would happen classically. So an infalling particle would just fall right into the singularity in finite proper time, which is indicated by the fact that the black line goes to zero at a value of proper time here, 2 point something. So in the red case is what's coming out of the effective dynamics. And again, what we see is that the radius decreases, but then bounces, and then undergoes damped oscillations and settles into that finite value. And so this observer is falling in towards the singularity, but then in terms of the two-sphere radius, what happens is that the observer sees damped oscillations, and then that settles into a finite radius. And this would take, and this observer would continue and stay at this position for infinite proper time. But the particle is kind of settling into a finite radius. And as I may ask, this radius is just dependent on the area gap, given by capital delta here, and the Amirzi parameter. And if we use, just plugging in numbers from the numerics, if we use the value of capital delta equal to the area gap and the usual value of the Amirzi parameter from black hole entropy calculations, we find that this PC component is on the order of the Planck length squared. So that means it's roughly 0.2 times the Planck length squared. And again, that's independent of the black hole mass. And so it's kind of settling into a Planckian radius. That's what it's asymptoting to. And the way I would interpret the results is coming from loop quantum cosmology, it seems that gravity is behaving repulsively here near the singularity. And so that's kind of analogous to the bouncing results of loop quantum cosmology. And like I said, this particle would then remain there for infinite proper time. Another thing one can ask is, what about the value of the curvature where these quantum effects occur? And so what I've plotted here is a logarithm of the Kretschmann invariant. And it turns out that doesn't blow up, again, indicating the absence of a singularity. And that also settles into a finite value as an asymptote, an asymptotic limit. And calculated numerically, the value just turns out to be 124, on the order of 124 times the Planck mass to the fourth. And so what we're finding again is quantum effects are occurring at Planckian curvature. Okay, any questions on that?
So Kevin, just to get some more clarification, if I would have done the mu naught phenomenology, would I get the Kretschmann invariant? Would I get the bounce at some Kretschmann invariant, or?
I think the value of the Kretschmann invariant would depend on all these gauge, the fiducial cell gauge issues and all that.
So then you think it will be similar to what happened in LQC, where the Ricci scalar could have been anything?
Yeah, I think it would be. Although I can't remember if we explicitly calculated it, but I would expect that.
Okay.
Okay, so we can move on to the next slide. We'll also just have some pictures of what the Penrose diagram would look like. The first Penrose diagram is the usual Schwarzschild, the usual black hole. On the right is what it would look like for an Nereid type spacetime. And so what we see is that in the interior region, which is labeled 2 on the first Penrose diagram, instead of having the singularity at the top, what we kind of have is glued onto that is a portion of the Nereid Penrose diagram. So that's the shaded part of the second diagram. That just gets glued on to the top. And then we're left with the interior region looking like the Penrose diagram, the third Penrose diagram listed here. And so as you approach the black line, the two-sphere radius approaches a constant value, that asymptotic value that I've shown previously. I just want to mention another caveat of the results, in that when we look at the effect of Hamiltonian and we look at what happens near the classical horizon, we find deviations there. So we're not entirely sure if this is a major problem. It could be an issue with the quantization scheme, or maybe that the Kantowski-Sachs approximation is not working in that regime. Or perhaps more realistically is that the boundary conditions that we're choosing should be more complicated. Okay. So why don't we move on to the next slide. And I'll just say one more thing on that caveat to the next slide to conclude. These are toy models that we're looking at, and we're asking the basic questions, you know, what happens with the singularity? And so far, in all the kind of models we've looked at, it seems that singularity resolution pops out. In particular, I've discussed the mu naught sort of quantization, and there the singularity is resolved, and this mu bar type quantization, and again the singularity resolved. But in terms of the detailed dynamical quantizations, it seems to be rather dependent on the quantization scheme, at least in the Schwarzschild interior case. So the one outcome that was first discussed is when these delta parameters are constant. This is the mu naught type quantization. It looks something like a wormhole-like solution where two black holes are being connected, and they could be a possibly different mass. But in the improved quantization scheme, what we find instead is that the interior is asymptotes to an Nereid-type spacetime, where an infalling particle is just going to end up being trapped at a finite Planckian radius and also Planckian curvature. But I did mention there are obviously caveats, and this is a simplistic model that we're looking at. But I would think of them as suggestive, but we, of course, want to move on and improve things and do things more rigorously, although that it's not quite clear how to make significant progress on that front because of the difficulty. But in terms of future work, what ideally what we want to do is move away from this Kantosky-Sachs type quantization and actually look at the entire space-time in an inhomogeneous spherically symmetric model. And the work that's been interesting to me so far is the work of that Jorge was involved in with Campiglia and Gambini, where they look at an inhomogeneous spherically symmetric model. And so far they have just the published work, they've just looked at the exterior, but hopefully they can extend those results to cover the whole space-time, and then we can look at that model. And ideally, we obviously want to get into and looking at collapse models, etc. But that's it.
So I have a question slash comment, which is that there is a little bit of a loose end that might be only of historical interest now, because it has to do mostly with a mu-naught type quantization. But is that initial analysis of these models was done with these recursion relations, and you know, Gaurav Khanna and others noted that they were unstable. And I believe that the analysis that you did, and then as other people did in simpler models, suggest that, you know, because in the mu-naught case, one can choose things such that the departure from the classical behavior happens wherever you like. Unless you fine-tune things, it's sort of not surprising that these recursion relations generically would become unstable and not recover the classical theory. Now, that's sort of a hand-waving explanation. I wonder if you have any more insights into that, or perhaps Martin and other people do.
Yeah, I don't think I have a great insight. Since I'm not overly familiar with the works on the stability, et cetera. But that could be the case. Although, I mean, our experience, like in the case of loop quantum cosmology, is that whether you use mu naught or mu bar doesn't seem to affect any stability issue. So I don't have any intuition on how that might affect things.
You mentioned this paper that Gaurav and Daniel Carson and I wrote, which is about these stability issues, which are in fact also improved at this different equation level.
Yes.
For such a mu bar scheme, but the same one that you mentioned and that one here. So the mu naught instability issues are not there anymore in this scheme.
But in your work, do you find that the mu naught scheme is unstable?
Well, that was actually the observation that Gaurav and Daniel made earlier.
Okay.
Last year, I think. Well, that's why we looked at this, the different representation and checked the stability there, and it turned out to be stable in this case.
Okay.
So, Jorge, can you have any comments about kind of relation between what Kevin just told us and what you have been doing?
Yeah, so Rodolfo and I have been writing a paper that got delayed, which has essentially the same results of Kevin in page 7 with a mu naught. We didn't do any mu bar things. They have slightly different treatment of things, and therefore results come out slightly different, but they're completely equivalent. So we're very happy with his treatment.
Okay, but you are doing it using kind of not doing the interior, right? I mean, you're doing everything.
No, we did the interior first, and that part completely agrees with Kevin. We're now looking to extend to the full Kruskal thing, and when we're progressing, but the calculations become more complicated. Things cannot be solved as easily in closed form and so on, even in the mu-naught case, which is the only thing we're looking at.
Right. Go ahead, somebody else.
Jorge, Param here. I wanted to ask a question. Since you mentioned, so in your analysis, do you also see a bounce like the way Kevin sees?
Yeah, we do see a bounce, but just like as I mentioned before, we can choose these deltas or these parameters like as usual in the mu-naught quantization to happen, make the sort of bounce happen earlier, or more precisely, the departure from classical GR to happen wherever you want, which is very undesirable, of course.
Okay. So you agree that if one does the mu-naught quantization in the Schwarzschild interior, like bounce can be anywhere?
I don't know if I would say bounce can be anywhere, but departure from GR happens wherever you want. And then therefore, it's not, I mean, when you think about it, none, it's all surprising that the theory is unstable, quote unquote, because you can depart from GR wherever you want, just choosing your initial data.
Yeah, I agree.
Yeah, so in that case, I mean, it is really completely analogous to the cosmological models, as everybody has emphasized so far. Because in the cosmological models, it really is, the initial data has to do with kind of the value of the momentum of the scalar field, d-phi. And choosing the momentum large, you can make departures from general relativity at low densities. And so here, the initial data would be the parameters like the mass. Choosing that, one could make departures from general relativity. That is what seems to make it. I have a few questions, Kevin. I mean, if we can go to page 12.
Uh-huh.
And I would like to you to go through slowly with this triangular diagram of the final diagram, which is supposed to be triangular, right? So we got the horizon, and then you have got various regions and slashed and unslashed lines and so on. So can you tell us what they are?
It's actually not so complicated. It looks very much like the ordinary Penrose diagram, other than that instead of having the wavy line representing the singularity, you have the black line, which is kind of asymptotic, which you asymptote to.
Right, which is cry in the presence of a cosmological constant. So that's exactly what would happen. By the way, is the value of the cosmological constant positive, which is what I think is happening here?
I think it is.
Otherwise, you would not get this cry, and various other things would not happen. But it would be good to check that, that it is actually positive.
I would say almost certainly it is.
Okay. So we got this cry up there.
In fact, let me stop you for a second.
Sure.
In the, if you go to slide 10, I have the Nerii line element there.
All right.
And there you have, in the GXX term, you have a square root of lambda. So I think, I mean, we get to this a solution that looks like a cosh squared of something times t. And so that would imply that we have a positive cosmological constant.
Yeah. And also the radius is 1 upon lambda. So negative.
Yeah. And going back to your question, I guess it's a 2S or something. I didn't create this diagram, but I think the 2S is kind of classical region and a dashed line goes to the more quantum region, but it's
just a transition from the kind of S is probably for Schwarzschild, N is for Nerii, right? I mean, that's the,
yeah, that makes sense.
Okay. You mentioned that in fact when you look at the geodesics, I think it was in the previous transparency 11 probably. That in fact, you know, the fact that the particle remains at some finite distance is analogous to what happens in quantum cosmology, that there is a repulsive force which is being, you know, counterbalanced, which counterbalances that attractive force, and therefore the particle remains as there. But there seems to be some slight difference here, right? Because in the case of quantum cosmology, this repulsive force is short-lived, it completely overwhelms and kind of causes a bounce. So here the particle is not kind of thrown away, what was would be singularity, but remains at some finite distance. Is that correct?
That is correct, yeah. So, I guess it's similar in a very rough sense. Yeah, it doesn't, like in the mu-naught case that I showed, it really does look like the bounce in loop quantum cosmology, where the PC actually bounces up to large values and goes back towards the horizon.
I just have just two small comments now. Then there are other questions people want to ask here. So one small comment is that when Madhavan and Victor Tavares and I have looked at the CGHS black hole, we looked at it from a full quantum point of view, and then it looks like even though there seems to be a semi-classical region, kind of the quote-unquote to the future of the singularity, which is what is happening in your case also. The region around where the classical singularity was the metric fluctuations are very large. Now, that is not something that can be checked in your effective equations, of course. But I think that is a very good motivation to really look at what happens, what would happen if one had looked at kind of quantum equations and not just the effective equations. I mean, one wants to know, is a situation like in quantum cosmology where basically you can actually write down a good semi-classical metric, that is to say the continuum picture seems to be quite fine throughout the bounds, or is there a region where this continuum picture really is bad and there are large metric fluctuations? And that, I think, is something that would be good to check. But as you said, that would require a lot of very careful work.
Yeah, that's correct. I wholeheartedly agree.
Okay. The second was a very short comment, and this is really to Carlo's question. Carlo, I just quickly dug out the paper that Martina and I wrote, and on page 396 and 97, the point that you just raised is discussed in some detail.
Okay, thank you. Can I react on that?
Yes, please.
I mean, what you were saying just before, I guess, is what I wanted to ask. I mean, for those of us who are less into this game, could you say a little bit more about this, what exactly goes into deriving the effective Hamiltonian? Because I mean, this is the main tool, right? So under what... physically, what is exactly one describing here? This is an approximation which is good for what exactly? I mean, in the quantum cosmology case, I was as far as the little I understand. I mean, I have a good physical intuition if I think that I can approximate a wave packet. The evolution of a wave packet across the singularity, and there is a notion. There is a notion of when the approximation with respect to a classical solution is good or bad. So here, first of all, I'm confused for two things. One, I have the physics clear in the cosmological case because there is a scalar field. So I sort of see clearly where are the degrees of freedom, what is one describing. While here, without the scalar field, I'm a little bit lost on what are the actual degrees of freedom we're talking about. There is a wave packet in what? Is this a wave packet of black holes with different masses, one with respect to the other and with a phase or whatever? And the second question is where does the approximation go wrong? I mean, is that goes wrong somewhere before this sort of peculiar universe on the other side with the fixed area develops? So, on the other hand, I cross a region in which the approximation go bad, and then I go back to a classical region or not? Maybe that's what you were saying also, but I don't know. This is not a clear question, but I hope.
No, I think to me it's pretty clear. So maybe Kevin wants to say something. If not, I can also add a few things.
Yes, thanks.
So in terms of knowing where it goes wrong, we don't have a good idea exactly. I mean, we only have, because the main problem is we don't have evolving semi-classical states, and everything is complicated, so we don't know exactly where things will go wrong. And so I can't give you a good answer that precisely is there some region in this dynamics where we expect this approximation to go wrong or not.
No, but I mean, there is a naive answer, at least I don't know if it's a good one, which is that what one is doing is replacing a variable by the sign of the variable, and therefore this is good when the variable is small.
Which variable are you talking about?
When you do write this Hamiltonian, it differs from the classical Hamiltonian.
Oh, the sine. Sure. You mean B?
Yeah.
Sine B. Yeah, right.
Yeah, that is one way of looking at it.
And when is B small on the evolution?
Well, B is small when it follows the classical. In all these plots that I have, where
it's small in both regions, right? Close to the singularity and also close to the horizon. Is that right?
Not necessarily.
Well, that's PC. That's PB.
PB would be small. That's correct. And it's slightly complicated because we really want to look at, for instance, delta B times B and delta C times C. But in our case, it is when these things become non-small is that when you expect the quantum effects to show up. And that's what I am looking at here is when these things not become small. That's what generates the differences from the classical behavior.
So in the classical theory, both B and C become large near the singularity. And the viewpoint, I guess, that Kevin is expressing is that is exactly the regime in which quantum effects should be, quote unquote, large if you're going to get deviation from classical theory. And so the effects are large there. So there is no, quote unquote, obvious inconsistency there. I mean, we would not want discrepancy in regions where the curvature is low. And roughly, that is where the B and C are, in fact, small. And so.
Yeah. But can I interrupt? Yeah, yes, I said that, but isn't that also the region where this approximation is supposed to go bad?
Okay. So let me start from
that. That's what's confusing me. I mean, I'm...
Okay, so the real way to do this calculation is the following way. One should really do the quantum calculation and then obtain effective equations from full quantum theory.
Okay.
Let's see what happens. Now, to a very good degree of approximation, this is what has been done in quantum cosmology.
Right.
And in unpublished work, Victor Tavares, which will be submitted very soon, has actually done it also for mu bar evolution.
Right. Okay.
So that one has actually started out with quantum theory and semi-classical states and then showing that, in fact, you get some effective equations. And then the statement is that, well, those effective equations, in fact, incorporate all the quantum effects. And not surprisingly, those effective equations show that, first of all, they agree with classical general relativity in the low curvature region, and they disagree with the classical general relativity in the high curvature region. But there, we are not surprised because...
Sure, of course, yes.
But the key point there is that the high curvature region, we did not just postulate something, but we obtained effective equations starting from full quantum theory. Now, having gained that insight, one can go back and examine that result and say that, well, supposing I was very clever and I did not really know the full quantum theory, what would I have, could I have guessed what the effective equation should be?
Mm-hmm.
And it turns out that, in fact, there's no logical justification for this, as I have emphasized many, many times. But it turns out, nonetheless, a useful fact is that, yes, it really is wherever the connection components occur, you replace them by sine of that divided by something. And therefore, in the present case, in the black hole case, we do not really have a good control so far on the full quantum theory, I mean, the mini superspace quantum theory. And so nobody has really constructed wave packets and derived the semi-classical equations in any consistent way. But if you like, this is a useful guess. And it is, because it is a guess, it is really open to the kind of criticisms you are just making. Namely, that the departures are large near the singularity, so why should I trust these effective equations? You're absolutely right. A priori, I don't know. But it's just that there is some experience gained in simple models, which suggests that this is not a good thing to do. That's my viewpoint towards all this. And the thing that I was just mentioning to get a while ago is that if for two-dimensional black holes, CGHS black holes, one looks at quantum theory, then one finds that, in fact, there is a region where effective equations actually fail. And yet, on the other side, so the effective equations are again very good. And so this is something that one has to actually check here more carefully. As Kevin has emphasized many times, we should not take these effective equations as a final word, but just as something that is giving us some insight in between, with all the caveats that Carlo has pointed out.
Thanks. Yeah.
And Carlo,
now it's much clearer, the picture. Yeah, thanks.
Okay, and you also asked about understanding what are the degrees of, what would be the degrees of freedom of the, in the quantum theory. In this
yes,
case,
how would I think about the wave packet? The wave packet of what? I mean,
yeah, so without, in this case where we wouldn't have a scalar field, but you still have a degree of freedom, as you pointed out early in the talk, one could take, for instance, a wave function as a function of both the triad components, let's say PB and PC, and then think of it as a wave function of PB evolving with respect to PC, something along that line. Whereas in loop quantum cosmology, it would just be a wave function of the triad component P and the scalar field phi.
Yes, but one of the tools you're telling me is not, doesn't have any direct physical interpretation. Do I still have to?
I don't think that would necessarily be a problem.
Think of this as being a clock, the one which does not have physical interpretation.
Oh, I see. So you can think as a clock. Is that the thing which is a clock at infinity that? No.
Well, in this model, it is true that the one that we are thinking of as clock is exactly one which is not a relevant finite.
Oh, I see. So the other variable is sort of the initial time at infinity, when one starts with a study. Is that something?
Yes.
Okay. Thank you.
Hi, Kevin. It's Mikhail. I would like to come back to Param's question, the first Param question, about inverse triad correction. So there is no really a page. I would like to refer to the first graph on page 11, I guess.
Okay.
So when PC becomes small, so we should expect inverse triad corrections to come in. And like one might naively expect that it would make the gravity force more repulsive and probably change the equilibrium value of PC, maybe make it larger. What do you think about it?
I'm not sure exactly how it would affect things. One of the problems that we face is that in terms of determining where the inverse triad effects occur, they're dependent on these gauge issues that we've mentioned in other points in this talk. So I could choose a gauge where that quantum effects occur at very large values of PC, these inverse triad effects. But we have chosen, because of these gauge issues, we have chosen not to consider that. So to answer your question, I don't know exactly how it would affect things. We didn't look at that specifically.
So this, how should I understand this graph, which gives this equilibrium value of PC to be like Planck in size?
In what sense to...
So you're saying that it depends on the gauge?
This graph here on slide 11 is not considering any inverse triad effects. It's resulting from my effective Hamiltonian without inverse triad effects.
Right. I'm saying that this PC value is really small.
Well, see, the inverse, in the case of inverse triad effects, because of the gauge issues, you can have them occur at any value of PC that you would like.
Uh-huh.
And so, the wherever those effects show up, your theory doesn't tell you whether 0.2 Planck length squared is larger than where the inverse triad effects occur, or whether it's smaller than where the inverse triad effects occur.
Oh, I see. Thank you.
Anybody?
Any other questions? Okay, so no further questions. Thank Kevin again. And we'll see each other, I guess, next semester then.
Okay. Thank you, Horace.